This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. And want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
Hi, this is Michael Dorn, Lieutenant Commander Worf from Next Generation and Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 214. You don't have to breathe that Z-Night. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Zachary Frueling. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including Mike Okuda's new design for NASA's Flight Operations Emblem, and the winners of the Calcom Tricorder X Prize. Then in the feature, we're joined by Amy Nelson and Justin Oster to discuss the original series episode, The Cloud Minders. So let's step into the Ready Room. Zachary, welcome back to the Ready Room. It's been a long time in terms of actual time, but in terms of episodes, it hasn't been so long since you've been here. There was a time not too long before I took my extended medical leave for eye surgery when you and your co-host on Matatrex, Mike, were taking turns sleeping on the sofa over there on the other side of the Ready Room.
It is great to be back in the Ready Room, and it's been a long time, quite a few months, and I'm podcasting all the time. I'm doing Metatrex every week and To the Journey every week, so I'm just, you know, been go mode, but I've missed being in the Ready Room with you. I hope you kept my cot warm for me. I'm ready to take up my usual spot.
Well, I will say that your cot was kept warm, but not by me. Actually, Data has been letting Spot sleep there while I was away, so it is quite warm. All right. Well, today we're going to talk about the Cloud Minders in the feature. We're going to be joined by Amy Nelson from Earl Grey and Justin Oser, our content manager for the network. But before that, Zachary, we have a couple of news items that I'd like to chat with you about and just see what you think about them. And the first one is related to NASA, but this is Mike Okuda, who all Star Trek fans know. He's the mastermind behind so much of the art and design of all the modern Star Trek series. He was tapped by NASA to design a new flight operations emblem. Now, NASA introduced a new group of astronauts last week, and these are the 2017 astronaut candidates, which are individuals who NASA has selected to undergo the candidacy training program at the Johnson Space Center and become astronauts. And this isn't the first time Mike has worked on patches for NASA. He's done stuff in the past, but they asked him to come in and do a redesign. And of course, we have that right here in front of us. What do you think about his work?
You know, this is really exciting. We are literally witnessing the next generation of astronauts. You know, you and I are old already. These are young people taking up the baton and going into space. One of these people might potentially be the first person to land on Mars. We have no idea, right? Great Good things point. Could happen. And, you know, in this day and age, you need branding, you need iconography, you need images to get people excited about things. And Mike Okuda is so brilliant at creating this iconography. I'm looking at this patch that he created from the Latin phrase. It says res gesta per excellentium, like great deeds through excellence. That's meaningful. We get the summation sign there, the mathematical summation sign, the accumulation of all of our knowledge. And it looks Star Trek-y. It's a really well-designed patch.
It looks Star Trek-y, and it also looks very modern. So the design, the typesetting and all, it's in a modern style. I mean, it reminds me in some ways of emblems that you would see related to sports teams. And I think it fits very well in with the culture of today, which is what we need. We need an updated look for some of these. Mike Okuda was talking to StarTrek.com about this, and he said, "I'm honored that this emblem helps to represent the commitment and courage of these remarkable men and women whose work on the final frontier literally takes them where no one has gone before." So, of course, he has a nice Star Trek spin on that. But, you know, the sentiment is absolutely true, and you made a great point there that one of these men or women, or maybe many of them, could be the first humans to set foot on Mars.
I'm kind of deconstructing this patch, so I hope I'm not picking this apart too much. But I love the blend of contemporary art, you know, the sans serif fonts and abstract designs. And it's also like nice, clean, crisp, mid-century modern kind of designs. Everything's a little abstract, like the spaceship that's depicted at the top is just a little wedge of a triangle. It's very abstract and clean.
Yeah, most definitely. So I mentioned that Mike had done design work for NASA in the past. In particular, he designed the STS-125 mission patch, which was worn by the crew of the space shuttle Atlantis in 2009. And that was the final servicing mission to the Hubble Space Telescope, which I remember at the time there was a lot of debate whether or not that was going to happen. And it seemed like they were going to not do that final servicing and they were going to let the thing just die there. But they did go up and they did fix the telescope, and that gave us many more years of information about our galaxy and universe that we wouldn't have had. And it's awesome that Mike was responsible for the patch for that one. You know, I remember I grew up in Alabama. I'm from Birmingham, and I remember going to Huntsville because the Marshall Space Flight Center is there in Huntsville. And I remember browsing in the shops there in particular, and they had all the patches from all the various missions. And so for me, this NASA iconography was very much a part of my youth and growing up. And as a Star Trek fan, it's really fun to see how Star Trek itself, being that fictional world, actually now connects with and ties in to NASA in this way.
I feel like we as Star Trek fans are kind of, we're the choir that's being preached to, right? We're inherently excited about going into outer space in any way, shape, or form. If anything, we're probably a little frustrated by the lack of acceleration of some of these programs that could really move us forward into the future. But we're not the target audience of this, right? I think it's a real challenge in this day and age. We're not living in these radically progressive times like the 50s and 60s when technology and exploration is happening almost weekly. Something new is happening. We've kind of plateaued technologically in some ways and in our exploration of outer space. So, you know, it's a real challenge. We need to get people excited about these things. And even though it's just, you know, there's a sense in which this is just a mission patch, right? It's not that exciting in the grand scheme of things. But if we can get the next generation of people, astronauts or the general population, excited about space travel, then we can really move ourselves into the future. And I would say that things like this play an important role in that.
And they play an important role still in the 22nd century because we see on Enterprise the nice patches that they have on their uniforms, right? So about this patch here, a little bit more background behind it. This was originally designed by artist Robert McCall and flight director Gene Kranz. And then in 2004, Jeff Hanley, who was a flight director and the head of mission operations, asked Mike Okuda to update the emblem. And what he wanted Mike to do was he wanted to include the International Space Station and also some of NASA's long-term goals, which are returning to the moon, and then, of course, what we've been talking about here, going to Mars. And so Mike Okuda made that update, and then he's also updated it two more times since then. He explained a little bit in talking to StarTrek.com about these changes, the latest changes, and he is merging, he's reflecting the merging within NASA of mission operations and the astronaut office. And so when you look at this patch now, the main text in the center, the white text in the red ribbon, says flight operations. And of course, that represents this merging of the astronaut corps and the missions operation team.
You know, I actually had to look at this patch a couple of times before I realized the subtlety of the connections that are in there. We've got the moon depicted, which is one of our goals, to go back to the moon. We've got a little sliver of Mars in there that I didn't notice at first glance, and that's one of our long-term goals. And it's not like we get a full circle of Mars's sphere. We get a crescent. It's on the horizon. It's out there in the distance. We also see the orbiting space station. What I don't understand, and maybe you can help me understand what this is, we see the little abstract space vehicle going up with a trail of smoke or light behind it. What is the little halo around that at the base of the spaceship?
Do you really have to ask, Zachary? I don't believe you don't get this. That's the warp field.
How could I miss that? Is that Wesley's warp bubble?
That's Wesley's warp bubble. That's right. If you look really closely down in the corner, you can see the traveler. No, but, you know, mentioning Mars and the moon here and the International Space Station orbiting, at the bottom we see the Earth, and the space station is represented by a star, basically, you know, like a bright light, which is what we would see if we just look up in the night sky. We're not going to see the shape of it. But then the moon and Mars are represented by the same symbol, which is just a little crescent. But the moon is silver and Mars is red. And Mars is a bit smaller and a bit farther off. And so it is this progression. So there is a lot of like little nuance going on in this design, which of course I would expect from Mike Okuda's talent.
What do you think of the giant summation symbol at the left? It looks like a giant letter E. I like it. I think it's a subtle nod to the accumulation of our human knowledge and technology. I think it's great. So it dominates the patch, though.
Yeah, I think from a design standpoint, I think it throws off the balance of the design a little bit. But I agree with you on its inclusion and what it represents, and I think it's quite appropriate having it there. It's it doesn't bother me, but yeah, I'm a very symmetrical designer myself, so it throws things off just a tad, but good addition. Well, lastly on this, I just wanted to mention the names of the astronaut candidates themselves. We have quite an interesting mix of people here. Kayla Barron, Zena Cardaman, Raja Chari, Matthew Dominic, Bob Hines, Warren Hoberg, Johnny Kim, Rob Coolin, Jasmine Mogabelli, Laurel O'Hara, Frank Rubio, and Jessica Watkins. So it, again, represents the diversity of the culture today, the diversity of the space program, and the diversity that we need to have as a species as we head out into space. And it's in quite stark contrast to the NASA of the 60s.
You know, I wasn't around in the 60s, but I'm kind of imagining this list of astronaut candidates in the early 60s with Neil Armstrong's name there. Mm-hmm. And just a name in a list, right? You know, just one among many, and not knowing that that would be a name remembered by history. We could mm-hmm. be looking at a name that history will remember for hundreds or thousands of years. We just don't know. That's the hopes we have for the future.
Yep, absolutely. All right, well, let's go on to the next story. And we're still dealing with science here. And this is about a medical tricorder. I'm sure you know, if you read news and you're a Star Trek fan, you probably know about the Calcom Tricorder XPRIZE. And we've talked about it here on the Ready Room in the past. Well, they awarded on April 12th the Calcom Tricorder XPRIZE to two teams, Final Frontier Medical Devices and Dynamical Biomarkers Group. Final Frontier Medical Devices received the first place prize, and they got $2.5 million, and the Dynamical Biomarkers Group received $1 million for second place. Now, more than 300 teams competed, and the goal, of course, is to create a functioning medical tricorder that serves a purpose similar to the one that we have in Star Trek.
You know when you're a kid and you have to do these egg drop challenges, like invent a little device that keeps your egg from breaking when you drop it off a ladder or something? That's what this is like. I'm trying to think, how would I go about this problem not knowing anything about the actual science? What about you, Chris? What would you do if you had to invent a tricorder right here, right now, and it was a challenge, a tricorder throwdown right now?
Well, interesting that you would ask me that question, Zachary, because I've given this quite a lot of thought and I have a plan. I have a go bag ready. If anyone asks me to do this, I'm going to head out and find Henry Starling because I'm pretty sure that he already has the technology. You know, he has that time ship that he found. And then, you know, I would just buddy up with him, take him out for some drinks, get some secrets from him and build the medical tricorder. And then maybe I could win the X Prize.
Yeah, Professor Rasmussen must have brought one back too, right?
Yeah, but he's so careless about things. You know, I think Henry Starling is much better at planning and keeping his game going over the long term. You know, Rasmussen, he could barely keep it going for a few days.
I see where you're going with this. I see where you're going with this. But as I think about the technologies that I would use, like how would I go about solving this problem? I would think that the combination of maybe 3D imaging technology, trying to miniaturize a 3D imager, like take a CAT scan or an MRI machine and get that sucker really small and combine that with some really strong, rich data analysis to just mine for the telltale signatures of various diseases. That has to be possible.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you would be on the right track because that's a bit of what these teams were doing. To win the prize, teams had to diagnose 13 disease states, and both of the winning teams obviously were able to do that. They met that challenge. There are a lot of challenges involved in building a device like this, but miniaturization, like you said, is one of the most important ones.
Yeah, we could build a room-sized tricorder.
To make it functional, to make it something that is like what they have in Star Trek, to make it something that doctors can use out in the field, it's necessary. You know, they have these attachments right now that they do use with iPhones. I know in Africa they use them to, you know, they can't hold wave it over you necessarily and scan and get all the information like Dr. McCoy would or Beverly would, but
just scanning for Zenite gas.
Yeah, scanning for Zenite gas, but they can use them, you know, quite effectively to provide better care for people in places that just traditionally don't have access to high technology in the medical field. But in this story, the story we're talking about comes from Scientific American. It's reprinted from an online publication called The Conversation and written by Despina Moshaw, which I may be mispronouncing that name, I'm sorry. But this story talks about a lot of the challenges. And in part of it, it says, while there has been significant progress in the developing bits and pieces of a tricorder, there is still work to do putting them all together in a genuinely handheld package. So that's one of the biggest keys. Various equipment needs to be miniaturized, and we need more progress in portable computers so they can handle all the information and data required for a complete picture of a patient's health condition. And then they close with saying that what we really need is a lab on a chip. But that doesn't sound so far-fetched to me, because if you look at what's in your iPhone right now, I mean, this is... it's an entire computer on a little tiny chip.
All the things we used to buy at Radio Shack that doesn't exist anymore are now in your phone.
Yeah, right. But, you know, the chips that are being made for computers today, and especially for mobile devices, you know, these, just one tiny chip has everything that used to take up half of your desk. And so the idea that they could put a lab on a chip is not far-fetched at all. It's just a matter of time.
It sounds like there's a real problem from reading the article that it's a problem in defining the success criteria. Like, when will we have succeeded? What exactly does a device need to do to be able to count as a tricorder? The article says that vital signs aren't enough. Like, okay, well, what does it mean to have a medical tricorder? What else does it need to do besides diagnose things and give you vital signs?
Yeah, exactly. And they're making progress towards that. Before Apple's Worldwide Developer Conference, WWDC, Tim Cook had been wearing some kind of special watch band, and he had made it known that he was wearing it. He didn't say it was an Apple device of any kind. And then when he went to do, I don't remember the event that he went to, but he went for an interview somewhere or some other event, and then suddenly he wasn't wearing that watch anymore. So clearly he didn't want people to see it up close at that point in time. And as I understand it, since then it has come out that that actually is something that Apple is developing. And it would be a band for the Apple Watch, which would contain some sensors that monitor glucose, which is very important for diabetics. And this Scientific American story actually talks a bit about glucose monitoring as being one key area, and also the most mature technology that we have at the moment. The article talks about portable home blood glucose meters that can test a drop of blood on paper, which can then be connected to mobile apps to allow diabetes sufferers to assess the severity of their condition. But I think, and I haven't seen it yet, and I don't know the details for sure, but as I understand from what I've heard, this watch band that Apple is working on, and I'm sure other companies are working on similar technology, would be able to measure those vital signs and get that data without the need for a drop of blood. So you would not need to prick your finger because diabetics have to keep pricking themselves, right? And so that's the next step. And if you can get that information without the need to take a blood sample, well, if you take that out another 5, 10, 20 years, the idea that you would be able to do that without contact anymore seems perfectly plausible. And that's where we get into the area of Star Trek style tricorder.
The Apple Watches are really interesting. I've heard from a couple of sources, and again, I can't speak to the veracity of this, but I've heard from a couple of sources that the Apple Watch is already better at predicting certain kinds of, you know, heart events and whatnot.
Yeah, I've heard that too.
Then they're allowed to really say. They can't advertise it that way, but I've heard that. I don't know if it's true or not, but it's an interesting challenge because you have to not only get the data, you need whatever sensors give you that vital information that you need to be able to run data analysis on it to get the conclusions you want. And then it's an interesting challenge to, you know, how do you process all that data and filter out all the false positives and make it really reliable? So there's not only the mechanical part of it, the sensors and the technology, there's the how do you process all the data and weed out the false positives and make sure you get a reliable result.
Well, it'll definitely be interesting to see how this technology evolves. I have, you know, there are a lot of technologies in Star Trek that I think are either impossible or we won't see in our lifetime for sure and may not see for many centuries. But a medical tricorder is one that I think we will see probably in our lifetime, because I think that we're already well on the way to it. And with the pace of advancement in technology and mobile technology in particular, it doesn't seem insurmountable.
It'll be interesting to see what form it takes, because in Star Trek, you know, we've got a very particular kind of form factor, you know, the flip open thing that we see in TNG and the later Star Trek shows. But what will it look like and what features of a tricorder will it have and what won't they be able to replicate? I'm not sure we'll even recognize it as a tricorder when it exists, I guess is my point. It's kind of there are so many different things that a tricorder could do, and it's a kind of a sliding scale. We'll make progress and progress. You know, in 50 years, will we go, these are tricorders, it's amazing, or will we still think there's work to be done?
I mean, I kind of think it'll look very much like a smartphone today, because the flat slab of glass with the touch screen is where everything has gone by pretty much every manufacturer. So, and it's a form factor that works really well. It's easy to use. It's easy to carry around. So I kind of think it'll go in that direction.
You know, it actually reminds me of a book I read recently called Enchanted Objects. And in that book, they try to make the case for the fact that the screen approach, the flat slab of glass, whether our iPhones or iPads or our tricorder, future tricorders, is not the way of the future. That what they anticipate seeing is technology embedded in objects that are much more familiar to us, you know, like umbrellas that light up when it's raining outside, that kind of thing, rather than looking at your screen to get all the information. So I'm interested to see whether the screen approach really sticks or whether for these medical devices, some sort of more familiar form factor emerges.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. Yeah. I will say that I think that our smartphones, this type of technology, will eventually be part of us, not something we hold in our hands, but a little bit further down the road. So maybe we can just wave our hands over people in the future and diagnose.
Doctors will just be walking tricorders and just waving their hands over their patients.
So I'll put a link to this article in the show notes on the show page if anyone wants to read it. It's on Scientific American. It's called How Close Are We to a Real Star Trek-Style Medical Tricorder? All right. Well, Zachary, that's all we're going to talk about in news today. So let's go ahead and bring in Amy and Justin and talk about the Cloud Miners. Kirk has a history of getting involved with the domestic disputes of other worlds and trying to set them straight. That's why the little Federation cleanup ship is always trailing the Enterprise. Of course, when the planet in question is a member of the Federation and is refusing to do its part to help another member world and is torturing its own people, it's a lot easier to justify stepping in. That's what happened in the third season episode, The Cloud Minders, and today we'll venture into the quadrant of the galaxy in which the Enterprise is currently operating to discuss the episode, and to help us do that, we're joined from the 24th century. We have a time traveler with us, Amy Nelson, co-host of our TNG show, Earl Grey. Amy, welcome for the very first time to the Ready Room.
Yes, thank you very much. Very honored to be here and looking forward to discussing something a little outside of my wheelhouse, the original series episode.
Well, you know, we just had the sofa over there recovered for your visit. We wanted to make the place really nice. We fed Livingston before you came in.
Excellent. And,
so he'll behave. Yeah.
And we carpeted the walls. And yeah, we're good.
We did. Yeah. All right. And we have to thank Guinan for the potpourri. That was her idea. Well, also joining us today, the network content manager. He was with us just last episode, Justin Oser. Justin, welcome back.
Hi, great to be here again on The Ready Room, and I'm excited to talk about an episode that has a lot of really thought-provoking things inside of it, so happy to be here.
Thought-provoking, like, you know, how could you maybe interrupt Ponfar if, you know, the right lady comes along?
Well, it provokes thoughts in different directions depending on which part of the episode you're in.
All right. Well, before we get into the discussion, let's give a quick synopsis. We used to do this all the time on The Ready Room, and since I came back from my eye surgery because of the long break, I kind of forgot to do it the last couple of times, but I think it's a good idea for those who haven't seen the episode in a while. Usually, I just ramble off a quick little synopsis of my own, but for today's discussion, because of something else I want to share, I pulled out the old Star Trek compendium by Alan Asherman. This is the original one just about TOS. And so I thought I would read the synopsis in there for the Cloud Miners and you guys just see how you think it fits in with the episode that you just watched. Stardate 5818.4, in quest of the crucial and rare element xenite, which is needed to stop a plague on planet Merak 2, the Enterprise journeys to the xenite-rich world of Ardana. The substance is excavated by miners, troglites, who are forced to live on the harsh surface of Ardana while the ruling class, Stratos dwellers, reside in a luxurious city high above the planet. When the troglites refuse to turn over the xenite, Captain Kirk is drawn into their struggle for equality. Plasus, the high advisor of Ardana's ruling council, maintains that the troglites are naturally inferior beings. While Mr. Spock is involved in a relationship with Droxene, Plasus's daughter, Kirk befriends Vanna, a troglite leader. Kirk, Vanna, and other troglites enter a xenite mine, where Kirk causes a cave-in that isolates them. He then has Plasus transported into the mine with them. Without protective gas masks, they all display violent, unreasoning behavior. Plasus, now aware of the reason for the troglite's mental state, promises to revise his planet's social structure, and the troglites gather the needed xenite. The end. All right. Was that a nice, quick, and fairly accurate summary, Zachary?
I think so. You know, I actually don't remember watching this episode for years. And over the years, as I learned more and more about Trek lore, I kind of built up in my mind that third season original series episodes aren't as good. And I just tended to skip over them, not think about them, ignore them. So when I rewatched it this morning, I really tried to make every effort to just bracket everything I knew about the original series, just sit down as if I were watching it for the first time. And I was amazed at how remarkably relevant this episode is for today in terms of economic stratification and cultural stratification. It's a metaphor for a great many things. I really loved this episode this time around.
Okay, interesting. Good. Because I feel like my opinion of this episode has diminished year after year after year since I used to watch it when I was growing up, but I do agree that it is very applicable to society today, for sure. Okay, well, I think those sound like initial thoughts, Zachary. So, Amy, share with us your initial thoughts on the Cloud Minders.
Well, listening to your synopsis, it seemed like, well, when I was watching it, I didn't see the xenite as such a main part of the show. Like, and the whole time I was watching the show, I'm like, I was upset because they kept saying that they were, you know, high and mighty, they were logic creatures. And then you see all the inequalities, which I'm sure we will discuss. And so for me, that was the main point. And then, you know, they kept throwing in this xenite thing and they were crushing it with their hands. And I'm like, what does xenite have to do with the whole story? I mean, because I had to, you know, really meld them together to see what it was, because I just didn't see the xenite as such a major character as you said in the synopsis, which I found interesting.
Yeah. What about you, Justin?
Well, let's see. So the first time I saw this episode, actually, because it took me a while to really get to the original series, was last year. And as I was going through it and following along with From There to Here last year, I watched this episode and I thought, this is kind of a weird episode. It doesn't really connect with me. I kind of wrote it off as, average fare for the third season. But then going into to watch it this time, like Zachary, I was just amazed at all of the things that, when I was sitting down to just kind of really pay attention to it and take some notes, there's inequality, there's torture, there's, questions of how different Federation worlds can act and can behave. And then there's just, it feels like there's a lot that was going on, and I had to actually, stop and think about some of it, because actually I think the dialogue in a lot of places is really well written. So I was actually impressed by it this time, and now in my assessment, I see it as one of the better third season episodes.
Were you impressed by the blue uniforms and the little hats that the Stratos guards wear?
No, the costuming was something I was not particularly impressed by. it was more, what they were saying and how they were acting. But it tends to be for me for TOS costumes that find some of them kind of ridiculous.
Justin, we were hoping to see your Sentinel costume at Star Trek Las Vegas.
No, I don't think you're going to see that.
I actually had a thought about your connection to the Zenite gas, Amy. I mean, this is coming out of 1960s drug culture in a way too, and we're seeing the youth of America, just zoned out on drugs. And this pick your flavor, right? And it's a real question, like what damage is it doing, and what's our responsibility to get people functioning at normal levels again?
Yeah, it could also be connected to the time where people were watching television more and more, and that was starting to erode their brains. And Zenite is actually just a misspelling of Zenith.
For the TV brand. Yeah. Well, that's quite interesting, because I actually saw the Zenite as representative of environmental degradation, in a similar way that lead in water can, lead to developmental issues for children or things like that. I hadn't actually thought of it in those other ways before.
Yeah, it definitely connects to that. And the idea that those in power don't have any concern for the fact that something like Zenite, or if it's lead in water or whatever it is that's contaminating the environment, is affecting its citizens. We see that all around the world all the time, both in the past and today. So this is one of those stories that is applicable then, now, and probably in the future it will continue to be applicable. Another parallel, talking about the differences in the society, this story takes some cues from a few other stories. One that's frequently mentioned, it's mentioned, of course, in the compendium here that I was reading out of earlier, is the 1927 film Metropolis, where you actually have part of the society living in factories that are underground, and then on the surface you have the big metropolis, you have the big city, where it's an Art Deco city and everyone's into culture and the arts and they live this luxurious life while you have people toiling underneath. And then the other thing that has always reminded me of, and when I went back to do a little bit of research before recording this Ready Room, I didn't find any reference to this, but in my mind, I've always connected the Cloud Minders with the time machine, in the sense that you had the Eloi and you had the Morlocks and you had this one society that was rougher and they were toiling, and then you have those who are so intellectual and so artistic that they've actually become weak. Now, the Stratos dwellers don't appear to have become weak at this point, but that particular separation has always been there in my mind. I don't know, Zachary, do you see any parallels, and are there any other stories that you think of when you watch the Cloud Minders?
Well, I admittedly haven't seen Metropolis, but as you're describing it, it sounds closer to Metropolis than to the Time Machine in my mind. Yeah, when I think, and it's been a while since I've read the Time Machine, but as I think back on what how the Eloi versus the Morlocks are described, the Eloi strike me as very almost pixie-like. They're kind of oblivious to this, how they got where they are and the history and the branching of the evolution, and they really seem radically ignorant of the situation. Whereas the ruling class class in the CloudMinder seems much more aware of how they got that way. And they've somehow justified it to themselves. Like, you know, it's okay, you know, that the troglites, you know, lower mental capacity is somehow part of their inherent nature. And we've just learned to live with it. And we're better than they are. And it's just outright superiority. It's like a superiority complex. So they just seem much more aware than the Eloi and the Time Machine. But it sounds closer to the Metropolis that you described, which I haven't seen, you know, insofar as there's workers underground and people living in a city and they're into the arts and whatnot. But the name Stratos is really interesting because it got me thinking about, I mean, it's a well-chosen name because it connotes like stratification, right? We have cultural stratification and economic stratification, and that is more like Metropolis in my mind. So
I was just thinking as you were talking, you know, I was recently on Standard Orbit and we were talking about Spock's brain. And again, this parallel of different groups of people living on different parts of the planet and how I'm like, well, this is just the same thing. In Spock's brain, you have the people living on the surface and then those underground. And now this one is just flip-flopped. You have people living on the surface and those living in the clouds. And I thought that was interesting. Again, you see this differentiation of social classes and their purpose for this supposedly one planet. I thought that was an interesting parallel.
How about you, Justin?
Well, so it's been many years since I've seen Metropolis, but from what I remember, yeah, I mean, it seems like a fairly close parallel, although in Metropolis, you know, it does focus on this rebellion that's going on to try to, you know, equalize things or overthrow the power that's there. And I think in the end, they do figure out some way to mediate their differences. You know, one of the things...
Which is basically what happens here. I mean, the troglites, there's this rebellion. We don't get to see much of it, but that's what's going on. And then in the end, apparently, they do work things out. But again, we don't get to see that either.
Although I think one of the things that compendium synopsis is missing is that this high advisor Plasus, I mean, not only does he think that the troglites are inferior, but, you know, he's willing to say, you know, at one point in the episode, the next time Kirk appears, kill him, you know, and he says at another point, like, if I can get this Xenite for you and kill every troglite that's below the surface, I would do it. So there's something that's really extreme about, you know, his rhetoric. And even in the end, he's very angry in that ending scene. He's like, I'm going to bring you up on charges, Kirk, and, you know, we'll see what happens. I mean, they've gotten to this point where the troglites have the power, hopefully, to effect some change. But you get the feeling that as soon as Kirk beams out, this guy's going to do everything he can to suppress that. So it's not quite as settled as I remember Metropolis being more settled by the end.
Yeah, true.
It struck me that this episode is more relevant today, that even more today than it was back then. And I came across a term recently, and I hope I don't butcher this, but the term I heard was white utopias. That as demographics have shifted, as cities are being revitalized, you're ending up with poor people and minorities leaving the cities towards what used to be, you know, white suburban neighborhoods, and demographics are really shifting. Mm-hmm. And again, I really don't like the terms. I don't like what it connotes. I don't like the implications of it. But, you know, upper class white people are kind of developing these little walled, kind of self-protected neighborhoods, you know, out in the woods in Montana and up in Seattle and various places that, you know, they've kind of just bracketed themselves and walled themselves off from everything that they perceive as culturally different from them or something to be afraid of. They're just walling off the change around them. And that's really what's happened in this episode. You know, we have a bunch of people that have decided to collectively separate themselves from everything they don't like about society.
Yeah. Well, society is definitely, we talked about this, it may have been on the Ready Room, or maybe Matthew and I talked about it on the Orb recently. The fact that society right now is segregating itself into all these little niches, right? And all these little cliques. And it is creating, well, it's creating a lot of problems with communication for sure. But if you take that out far into the future, it could evolve into this type of situation where you really, really have no compassion for the other side at all anymore.
Yeah. And I think the thing that's so disappointing about this episode, and we see it in the world around us, is that people forget that the goal used to be equality and egalitarianism and a strong middle class. You know, we want to bring people more, you know, closer together and, you know, people living alongside of each other, having, you know, respecting each other, treating each other as equals. And that was the goal. And people are really, they've kind of gone the other direction. Self-segregating is a good way to put it.
Yeah. And one day it may swing back the other way. But right now we're on a swing in the other direction. About the name, it is a really clever name, Stratos, because, again, we are talking about stratification, which I'm sure is part of it. And then also it is a cloud city, and Stratus, with a U, Stratus, those are the clouds that are fairly low. You know, they're about 2,000 to 7,000 feet up, so they're not the really, really high up clouds. And that's about where you are with this city, right? It's up in the clouds, but it's not so far up that there aren't going to be airplanes flying by it or anything. It's just kind of floating up there. So it is a really clever name that they came up with.
It's a great play on words. Even the name Troglites, of course, is a play on troglodytes, you know, cave dwellers. And I was wondering, I was trying to think through the names and the references and the well-chosen words in this episode. Does the character's name Droxene, does that mean anything in particular? I couldn't find anything online. I tried to do a quick search. You guys know what that really means? I don't know.
I thought they just, you know, changed some letters on Roxanne or something.
It sounds like something you take for a headache or some back pain or something.
Take some Droxene. Yeah.
It was a really great police song for sure.
Droxene.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know.
That's the one where Leonard Nimoy was singing backup with Sting on that.
Yeah, I can picture it. Droxene. Yeah. You don't have to put on
it
the Z
night. Doesn't have to be every 7 years. Droxene. Yeah.
You don't have to breathe that Z-Night.
Tonight. Yeah. I don't know if that name means anything in particular either, unless it means attracted aliens. I don't know. Yeah. Okay, one other thing to talk about, and this is something that you brought up, Justin, on the other side of the room.
The other side of the room.
Is the fact that Ardana is a member of the Federation. But as you put it, they seem to have some leeway for refusing the requests of a Starfleet captain. And of course, they're oppressing a segment of their society and they're using torture. And so it begs the question of what rules govern how a Federation member can conduct its own affairs and what's allowed and what isn't. I think that's a really interesting question in Star Trek in general, even later on when you get to The Next Generation, which, unlike the original series, The Next Generation is sort of like, let's kind of police this giant Federation that we've created and let's go on diplomatic missions and transport people around and make sure people do what they're supposed to do. That's sort of what Picard does for so much of the series instead of exploring like Kirk does. And they have to hold everything together. But even in that setting, it really isn't clear what it means to be a Federation member world and what you're allowed to do and how much autonomy you have. My thought on it has always been that in reality, it would not make sense for there to be a central government for a federation of planets, of 300-something planets that are spread all over two quadrants of a galaxy, because how would you enforce any rules, really, over distances like that? And so maybe it's more like confederation, you know, it's more like it's just a loose-knit. They've agreed to support each other and work together in some way, but it's not a situation where one central government sets all the rules and then everyone has to follow it. But what are you thinking, Justin, on this?
Well, I mean, my thought is, we don't really get anything about this in TOS, but we do a little bit in TNG where they talk about, you know, in order to apply to be a member of the Federation, the planet has to be unified in some way. And one would think that they need to have certain norms, like, you know, people can vote for their representatives, torture's not used, things like that. So I was actually really surprised to see this because I thought, you know, this high advisor Plasis keeps telling Kirk, you know, don't interfere with our local government. We need to do what we need to do. Don't worry, we'll get you your thing and we'll take care of, you know, the other parts to get there. Don't worry about that. But it just feels to me that there's something that feels wrong about, you know, especially when they you know, start torturing someone, that there should be something from the Federation to check every now and again to make sure that they're still doing the things that they should be doing or that were requirements for their application to the Federation. And inside the episode, you know, Kirk says, I won't stand for torture. You're going to have to torture us next, or, you know, not do it at all. So he's setting a firm line, but he's not saying you violated, you know, this Federation statute. So at least as far as TOS is concerned, it seems like there is some leeway and some kind of, you know, I think you're right, Chris, that it makes sense that these spread out member worlds would have, you know, their own laws and be able to do their own thing and not be micromanaged. But it does seem like there needs to be some rules or something so that if there's, you know, somebody that's coming by this Federation world, they can be seen as kind of a model and not, you know, having this stratified society that's really unequal where they're abusing people and using torture and all of that. So it just came up in my mind because I was just really surprised that they were a Federation member doing these things and mm-hmm. being allowed to do those things.
It strikes me that this is something that evolves over time. Just like here in the United States, we've developed a progressively stronger federal government from our beginnings to where we are now. It wouldn't surprise me at all that in TOS days that the Federation was more like a loosely associated confederation of planets than by the time the 24th century has rolled around that the federal Federation government has gotten stronger.
But even then, I don't think that the Federation government is really controlling the member worlds that much. I mean, we clearly see that Vulcan, for example, has its own laws that differ from those of Earth, and those are two of the founding members.
Well, I was wondering, so what is the benefit of, you know, joining this Federation, and what does the Federation get from allowing all these other planets and worlds to come in? So when I think about it, it's like, okay, so here's Ardana. And they're in the Federation and still have their class structures in place. So were they just accepted because the Federation wanted the Xenite, wanted their natural resource? I mean, what's the give and take for that? And then why would Ardana want to be in the Federation? Because they're not going to follow the Federation rules, if there are any, for individual planets. Is it just for protection, like military protection?
Well, I think you hit on the reason that the Federation wanted them, is that it is said that they are the only planet in the galaxy that mines Xenite, which makes me wonder, why is Xenite so important if there's only one planet in the entire galaxy that has it, right?
Right.
But of course, it works well for the story. As for what they get, military protection would be one of those things, I'm sure. We have to remember that at this point in time in particular, the Klingons were trying to expand their empire, and Ardana is in the Beta Quadrant, which is where Kronos is located. Mm-hmm. And so it could be that protection was valuable for them, or the Federation just wanted that planet because it helped create a beachhead between them and the Klingons. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But also there could be some other kind of, I started to say financial aid, but we don't use money in the future, but yeah. We do. So there could be, you know, food aid or medical assistance or who knows, you know, what kind of benefits member worlds get.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was thinking it has something to do with some kind of preferential trading relationship or, you know, they get things from other member worlds that they need in exchange for their Xenite. So I think it's those kinds of things plus the protection from other powers that are out there.
Yeah, it's not quite imperialistic, though, because, I mean, Kirk doesn't have much of an influence on the governance of the planet when we see him, but it's more like a 23rd century spice trade or something.
Hmm. Well, Kirk never seems to have much authority, whatever planet he goes to or whatever,
only with
whatever
the
Federation facility he goes to assist with something. They're always like, oh, great, the Starfleet captain's here. Yeah, like, we're really going to listen to you, right?
Yeah, and he has to push it. Yeah.
And I like that the Troglites were afraid of the fact that there was a Federation starship there. You know, Vana basically says, you know, starship captains and starships don't carry cargo. And he says, well, we do when we need the Xenite to solve this problem.
Well, they also carry those spicy chili peppers, remember? I'm going to get those delivered, too. It is a really good question as to what's allowed. A little bit of background. So with Ardana, it's very, very vague. But if you read a bit of the background to Ardana, the caste system must have existed before they became a Federation member, because you don't just suddenly set up a caste system in your society like this. But it seems, based on the information in various sources that have come out since, that the government was a little bit different than what we're seeing here with the way that Plasus is behaving, that they maybe had more of a global government. Although he's a representative of the council, I guess, right? He seems to kind of be doing his own thing. Yeah. He clearly feels that he's an authoritarian figure and he's going to make all the decisions. But I get the feeling that the Federation wanted this planet as a member for whatever reason, probably Xenite. And after they became a member, there was this rebellion, there was some shift in the government. Maybe the government cracked down more. Perhaps they weren't torturing people prior to what we're seeing here. And there's been this change. And then that makes you wonder, what does the Federation do when a member world shifts in that way and starts to take on characteristics that go against the foundation of the Federation charter in the first place?
Yeah, is there some sort of process for like removing a world from the Federation? If they go too far from Federation norms and values and ideals?
I think so. I think they hold a Fexit vote. Exactly. They decide that they are going to leave the Federation.
Yeah.
This is Stratos, though. It might be a Strexit vote.
Maybe. Yeah, Strexit. Now, there's hard Fexit and there's soft Fexit. And you have to decide which one's going to work best for you.
Well, there is, in the books, there is actually a member world that does secede at one point. So I guess you could say there's some kind of process, but it's a good, I mean, that's what came to mind. Like, do they have Federation officials coming by every so many years just to see, hey, are you still doing this, 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 and this? Okay, great. We'll go. Oh, you're not? Well, let's see what we can do to help you out with that. There's a lot of internal workings that we don't know about.
That was my question, because if you look at, you know, when they're coming in and you're basically hearing about Ardana for the first time, they look great on paper, right? They're very logical, artistic. They have the best art of the planet, and they're so just intuitive. And, you know, you have that written down on paper and you say, yeah, this looks like a great, let's get them into the Federation. But then when you really go and look and you're like, how is it that they could call themselves enlightened and ignore their class status and that they basically have slavery and they don't believe that everyone can learn and they have this toil versus leisure separation? And it just really begs the question, like, how can they be so blind when they call themselves enlightened?
Yeah. Well, and what I think of also is, so Plasus is this high advisor and he talks about the city council at one point. So there's the city of Stratos and the people that are below the troglites. Is this going on all over the planet? Are there different, you know, cloud cities and different, you know, troglite dwellings? I mean, I think, you know, within the scope of these episodes, you can only see this one city, but it's making it seem like maybe that's going on all over the planet. Maybe there's something different that's going on and the Xenite is just in this one part of the planet. I think, you know, I don't know how representative it is of everything. They're making it seem like that's the whole planet, but it's really one city that you're looking at.
Well, that's a consistent problem in Star Trek, which is you visit a planet and you see one city or you see one little society on the planet and you really don't know what the entire planet's like. I mean, if someone landed on Earth, if they landed in the US or Russia or Japan or Brazil or wherever, and they take that one sample and then they think, well, that's Earth. But you know, it's very, very different all over the planet. So it's a good question for sure.
I think of this as a really interesting deconstruction of the ivory tower. I mean, we've got a society that has, on the surface, has logic and art and high ideals, and there's this dark underbelly to it. And a lot of our, you know, most prized institutions have a dark underbelly. There's the internal politics, and then there's the inequality that you don't see. And you're seeing kind of seeing the poster face of the society, but you're not seeing the dark underbelly until you get into the mines.
One important thing, though, that you missed, Amy, is that I think what really happened is that the Federation representatives who went there to do the checklist that Justin mentioned, they were just thrown off by the license plates. They said Ardana, and at the bottom, they said, looks great on paper. Yeah. And so they thought, this is it. I mean,
Well, maybe they did what Plasse's wanted Kirk to do, which was to beam to Stratos first. He could explain the situation. Maybe they just went to Stratos and they're like, look at all of this great art. We're so logical. We're so great. No, there's nothing else going on. You can go now. Yeah. You know, I mean, that's what they wanted Kirk to do, to visit them there so they could, you know, frame whatever narrative they wanted or however they wanted him to see the place, you know.
Nice art. Yeah. Great city. You're in the Federation.
Yeah.
Yeah. And plus they met Droxine, and so did anyone else get the feeling when Plasus introduces her and he says, one of our planet's most incomparable works of art, my daughter, Droxine. Did you ever get the feeling that it was kind of like a Donald Trump thing where he's saying, like, you know, if she weren't my daughter, I'd probably be dating her.
You're so bad.
Well, no, I didn't quite go there, but I had a real problem with the way he introduces her, because it's like she's a piece of property, like the art on the wall.
Like a trophy daughter.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think that's a time period thing. You know, that's the trap that people fall into when they watch the original series, especially, is that they judge what they're watching based on 21st century values and principles, which you really can't do. I mean, you can do it, of course. But I don't think it's the right way to judge it. You have to look at Star Trek is a creation of its time. So to understand what you're seeing, and I think to make sense of it, and also to gain value from it, to see what progress we've made and what progress still has to be made, you do have to judge it by the time period. And so him acting that way about his daughter doesn't surprise me for something in the late 1960s. Now, of course, today it would be quite inappropriate, and we would not believe that someone would say something.
But like parts of this are just high society, though. I like when he says, "Okay, go run off and practice your music now." That's something you'd hear in any high society family today, I think.
Mm-hmm. Also, in high school, that's what I used to tell my geometry teacher. I'm going to run off and practice my music now.
Yeah, I understand it's of its time, but it still bothers me when I hear it to my ears, you know.
But. Well, I think in part, and maybe I'm reading more into it, but, you know, you have how Droxine is treated, and then contrast to what I forget her name, the one who's
Vana.
Doing Vana. Yeah. And how she's so strong and is the leader. And so you have that difference between them that just really is set apart on how people treat them. And I think, again, you hear that TOS is revolutionary for its time, and just, again, another example of how women play an important role in the stories of TOS.
I feel Droxine very much represents that sheltered person, though, going back to the high society thing. She doesn't have anything to worry about. She's sheltered, whereas Vana is more of the real world. And so she is more capable. She is more take charge, as I think most women would be. There's just, in the case of Droxine, it's this great contrast of someone who's been sheltered in this palace and really wants for nothing and doesn't know what's going on the outside.
Well, at the same time, as the episode progresses, Droxine, you know, has her doubts, and she's very thoughtful about it, where Plasus is still like rigid and resistant to everything that's going on. But she's asking questions, and she's, you know, being open to how what she's seeing can change her mind. So I mean, I think actually, you know, she's sheltered, but she starts to come out of that and to really, you know, ask the questions that you're asking as you're watching the episode. So I think that's important as well. She's not just something to look at in the episode.
She's having her eyes open, but on the other hand, there's almost this helplessness to her. Like, she, you know, yes, she's part of the group that has all the resources. She's up in the clouds. You know, I can imagine, I don't come from an upper class, you know, family or society really, but I can imagine being in that situation where your eyes get open, you start to see the suffering of others, you get some empathy, and then you're like, God, all this stuff around me, how do I change all of this? Like, even if she wanted to change it, how would you go about changing that entire society? It's a massive problem when you start deconstructing what needs to be changed in order to, you know, make a more egalitarian society.
Well, and I think her solution at the end is to go and, you know, live among the troglites, which I was surprised by at the end. I was like, wow, that's a hard thing to do, but she's going to do that and try to understand more what's going on.
It's like she's joining the Peace Corps or something.
Yeah.
The Ardana Peace Corps. Yeah. Well, while we're talking about Droxine, I want to talk about Flirty Spock, because this is something that I always remember from this episode. It really stands out because in Amok Time, when Spock undergoes Ponfar, he doesn't want to talk to Kirk about it, and it's played up as this big thing that's secret that the Vulcans don't talk about with anyone. And here, I mean, Droxine seems to be aware of it a little bit, and Spock wants to talk to her about it, and he opens right on up. And he even suggests that, you know, maybe it doesn't have to be every 7 years. But she gives, this was the weirdest line. Of course, it is 1960s, so I get it. But regardless of the time period, it's just the idea that Droxine, she just meets this alien, Spock. She's known him for a couple hours, maybe. And she's like, isn't there anything that can change your mind? Like, she wants to jump in bed with Spock, who she met a couple of hours ago, this alien. Just that by itself seemed quite odd to me.
I really can't decide if Spock has all the moves or if he's really bad at this. You know, he's like, yeah, the 7 year cycle is innate to Vulcan physiology, but you could make all the difference.
Right.
Yeah, and they're flirting in a serious way, you know. I mean, it kind of starts a little bit earlier. I laugh when I hear her ask about Captain Kirk and his very attractive officer, and she's talking about Spock, which kind of mirrors, I think, how, you know, some women might have seen the series in the 60s, like, Spock's the sexy one, it's not Kirk. But,
well, yeah, that's true.
I think we've
yeah.
forgotten and, that, haven't we? I mean, know, that's a that, thing, but we've forgotten that that was actually true, that people found Spock as the sexy one.
Yeah, it was. And Justin, you know, Dax agrees with you.
Yeah, well, she was there.
That's something that Droxine and Dax have in common. They both love themselves some Spock.
Yeah, but it is really striking because there's all of these, you know, questions of, you know, inequality and rebellion and, you know, all this stuff that's going on. And in the middle of it, there's this thing that's going on the side where Droxine and Spock are really heavily, you know, kind of flirting with each other. And I think at the end of the episode, Droxine has, you know, kind of this look like, oh, I can't believe I'm not, might not see Spock again. It's just an odd thing that I don't know if you see much. I just didn't expect it, you know.
I know. Yeah. I was sort of wondering why it was even written in that way. Like, it didn't advance the story, in my opinion, anyway. Maybe, I mean, we already knew right about Ponfar, so it didn't give us any extra insight into Spock's culture or anything like that. So I was a little confused as to why it was in there. I don't know.
I can only think it's a wink to, you know, fans that found Spock really attractive.
I can kind of picture, like, you know, getting back to the high society thing, I can kind of picture, like, this high society daughter that gets a rock and roll boyfriend and he's kind of corrupting. He's going to take her away from everything that's comfortable and familiar.
So, like, if Spock had beamed down wearing a leather jacket, would that have just pushed her over the
totally.
Edge? Is that what you're saying?
Hop on the space Harley and off we go.
Love
oh, it would have been awesome if he had a flying motorcycle like in Battlestar Galactica 1980. You remember those orange and white flying motorcycles that they had when they got to Earth? And a black leather jacket, that would have been.
I mean, Spock's kind of like a cowboy here in a way, like getting on his horse and riding off into the sunset and leaving the girl behind.
Spock's the bad boy. I mean, yeah, you always hear that Kirk is the playboy and the one that gets all the girls. And I don't know. I think Spock's got his own game there, too. And
well, I think Spock's leaving a trail of broken hearts across the galaxy.
Now, in all fairness, Kirk was having some fun in this episode trying to wrestle the, you know.
Yeah, he's like, ooh, I'm enjoying
it's
this.
It's like some sort of like it's like a clothes iron dagger she has. You know, isn't that the weirdest dagger that they've got? It looks like a little like iron and something you'd whip out and iron your uniform with.
Well, you know, when Plasus asks the troglite, what happened to your mining instrument? And then he pulls it out and he goes, could it be this? And I'm expecting the guy to go, no, that's a cheap prop. I could never dig Xenite with that.
Yeah.
So, Amy, you're asking, why is it written that way? One thing that's in the compendium, they're talking about the third season and the reaction at the time to what was happening with Star Trek after the letter writing campaign and Star Trek came back for the third season. But there were a lot of personnel changes that happened on the show, which really affected the quality. Gene Roddenberry was going to come back and be the line producer, which he was in part of season one, but NBC would not move the show back to the time slot he wanted, so he would not agree to do that. And so they brought Fred Freiberger in, and he became the line producer. And then they also had other changes behind the camera, which affected the writing of the show and the presentation of the characters and the photography and such. And Variety wrote in their September 25th, 1968 issue that Star Trek, quote, retains its vigor and spatial spookiness, although its chief characters are largely caricatures and the dialogue tends to turgidity. So they were really not happy with the way the characters were being written. And you often hear from fans, especially those who grew up watching the original series, and you said this at the beginning, Zachary, that you had come to kind of think that third season TOS episodes aren't as good as first and second. And you get some people out there who just really say that the third season's not even canon. The third season's terrible. And talking about Mr. Spock, now this is Alan Asherman in the compendium. He wrote this really, I think it's funny, paragraph about Spock. He said, Mr. Spock was certainly the character who had the most exposure during Trek's third season. The evidence would indicate, however, that Dr. McCoy's operation to restore the Vulcan's brain in the season opener was not entirely successful. During these last segments, Spock joined a band of space hippies in a jam session, sang ballads, laughed, and recited poetry, reacted emotionally toward an illusion, voluntarily discussed Vulcan sexual matters with a woman he had just met for the first time, came close to strangling Dr. McCoy, tasted meat, and conspired to mutiny. The actual responsibility for these activities and attitudes, however, does not lie with Mr. Spock, but with those who chose to exploit his box office potential at the expense of Star Trek's continuity and credibility.
They make it sound like Spock mined a little too much LDS down in those caves.
I think so. My favorite part of this is the bit about, comma, tasted meat. Like of everything else that he did, he tasted meat.
Therefore, that proves that his brain was not put back correctly. Yes, that's it.
But let's be fair to Dr. McCoy. Whose fault is that? Spock is the one that performed his own brain surgery.
But yeah. Speaking of Spock, one thing that stood out to me, it's just a little thing, but I noticed that he gets to make a captain's log for Captain Kirk. It starts out captain's log, first officer Spock reporting. Uh-huh. And he gets this almost like a journal or a diary entry, a verbal diary reflection in the middle of the episode when he's reflecting on the society. And it's the thing that I love about it, it's all very socially aware and well written. It's really well done. But Spock's verbal description of everything going on struck me this time.
This would be like if in The Next Generation, you hear Captain's Log, First Officer William Riker, recording for Captain Picard, who's currently on holiday with Fosh, right? I mean, speaking of that, this is one of the changes that I was talking about earlier. They talk about how this changed some of the literary formats as well. And one of those things was the use of what we see with Spock here, where we have these sort of log entries or we have these flashbacks where they fill in past events where they fill in supplemental information because he felt that maybe the audience wouldn't quite understand what's going on. And it's done in a way that we don't really see in the first and second seasons of Star Trek. So it does change the literary style and the presentation style a bit of the original series.
It also is a great way to save a little money, right? The more you talk about it, the less you have to film it.
True. You know, I see Spock's role in this episode being what it is because, you know, he doesn't have any science to do in this episode. McCoy's doing the science to figure out, you know, why the troglites are having some issues with their mental capacity or their intelligence. So what does Spock have to do but, you know, look pretty and flirt, you know, and have some captain's logs while Kirk's on the surface? I mean, really, like, what else would he have to do? Because there isn't, you know, that science for him to do in this episode.
They could have at least had Spock invent the little Z-Knight gas mask.
Yeah. Oh,
with the little space nerds inside the tubes.
The you know, but apparently they got those masks by attending Mardi Gras at some parade in New Orleans because I love you've got the green, gold, and purple little beads in there. So festive.
And then you've got like this metal thing to keep it to your head. Is it really going to stay on your head with that metal thing protruding out of it? Like what?
I mean,
what
don't
mask
even
has
turn
that?
your Yeah, don't even turn your head too fast because it's just going to fall right off. And how
We had a piece of metal behind the scenes, so we'll just stick it on there and you're done. It's
well, you know, the Federation, they're not known for their airtight protective garb design. If you remember in the Naked Time,
yeah,
when they beam down to the planet, I mean, that dust is going to get right up under those suits, those little loose mask helmets they had on.
Sure will.
It's yeah. just a prototype, right? Are we being too harsh?
It's a prototype. Okay. Yes.
Well, no, McCoy said these are masks that they use for other things. So we already had one handy, mm-hmm. you know, and that's what it looked like. It had a piece of metal to mold it to your head.
What was its original purpose?
I think spray painting the Enterprise, actually, is what it looks like.
That could be. I don't know. Other situations where people are mining things that emit harmful gases. Who knows?
All right. Let's talk about one other thing, which is David Gerald's original idea. And this one is coming from the world of Star Trek. I'm going to read it from Memory Alpha. But David Gerald describes his original story, which got changed quite a bit. And I'm just curious to get your thoughts on whether you think this would have made a more interesting story, if they should have kept some of the parts of it, or if you like what they did. So David Gerald said about his original story, which was called Castles in the Sky, it was intended as a parable between the haves and the have-nots, the haves being the elite who are removed from the realities of everyday life. They live in their floating sky cities. The have-nots were called mannies, for manual laborers, and were forced to live on the surface of the planet where the air was denser, pressure was high, and noxious gases made the conditions generally unlivable. The Mannies, torn between two leaders, one a militant and one a Martin Luther King figure, mind you, this was in 1968, shortly after King was assassinated and just before the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. In my original version, Kirk, Spock, McCoy, and Uhura were captured by the Mannies when their shuttlecraft was shot down by a missile. The Enterprise desperately needed dilithium crystals. This planet was one of the Federation's biggest suppliers, and Kirk's concern was to restore the flow of crystals. He didn't care who worked the mines, just that the supply was not interrupted. The shuttlecraft was necessary because I felt that the crystals might be too dense for the transporter. In the process of the story, Kirk realizes that unless living conditions for the Mannies are improved, the situation can never be stabilized. Because Uhura had been injured in the shuttlecraft crash, McCoy starts treating her in a Manny hospital. But he is so appalled at the condition of the other patients there, especially the children suffering from high pressure disease, that he begins treating them as well. Meanwhile, Kirk and Spock have convinced their captors to let them go up to the Sky City and try to negotiate a settlement to the local crisis. The story focused primarily on the lack of communication between the Skymen and the Mannies. Kirk's resolution of the problem was to force the two sides into negotiation. He opened the channels of communication with a phaser in his hand. "You sit there! You sit there! Now talk!" And that's all he does. He doesn't solve the problem himself. He merely provides the tools whereby the combatants can seek their own solutions, a far more moral procedure. In the end, as the Enterprise breaks orbit, Kirk remarks on this as if inaugurating the problem-solving procedure is the same as solving the problem. He pats himself on the back and says, "We've got them talking. It's just a matter of time until they find the right direction." And McCoy, who is standing right next to him, looks at him and says, "Yes, but how many children will die in the meantime?" The answer was not a facile one. The viewer was meant to be left as uneasy as Kirk. Somehow, I think it lost something in the translation. So, that was Gerald's original idea. It's quite similar, but I think with what you see with a lot of things, like The City on the Edge of Forever as well, the original story there, some of the ideas that the writers were going for in a science fiction context were maybe just a little bit too much for TV at the time, and they got sort of watered down so that they would fit into what Gene Roddenberry wanted and also what NBC wanted.
Honestly, no offense to David Gerald, but I think I like the way the episode actually turned out better because as you described it there, it sounds like The story was originally mainly about the economic stratification with some sort of negotiation. It's not a happy resolution, but I like what the Zenite adds to the story, honestly, because I think the Zenite is what allows the ruling class to look at the working class and view them as not able to come up to their level, right? They're inherently like culturally and biologically stratified. But it's all caused by the Zenite, of course. But I think that is what causes the real cultural rift that we see, and I find that a little more interesting than the economic rift.
Mm. So, Amy, you mentioned earlier that you felt that the Zenite really did not play so much of a role in the story. I mean, do you agree with Zachary on this?
Well, now, yeah, definitely after our discussion, I can see the Zenite having an important role and how it is connecting everything that I saw. And I do like how the episode plays out compared to what you read, in part because you get to see like that stratification much more clear. And it's not just about Kirk trying to solve the problem. I mean, that's sort of what happens, but we see them work through it together. And so I like how it plays out in the episode.
Amy, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you and I both come at this from the educator standpoint, which is that we would do our students a disservice to look at them and say, you're not able to come up to my level, right? The fundamental premise is anyone who works hard at it can achieve whatever level they want. And that's not what we see going on in the society. And from an educator standpoint, that's very disturbing.
Absolutely. One part of my evaluation, there actually is a category where I am judged, do I believe that every student can learn? And that mentality and that philosophy that I have, you know, because you do come across people, and unfortunately some teachers, that, oh, I can't teach you, mm-hmm. or I can't teach this certain type of person, is very damaging. And that definitely plays out here in this episode.
I have some thoughts on David Gerald's ideas. I mean, I think just from a practicality standpoint, if you're talking about there being two different leaders on the surface, you'd have to spend, you know, some time telling you what those leaders are like and what the movements are like. It may have just taken a while to do that. But I kind of like the story how it turned out, because the differences between, you know, the people in the Cloud City and the Troglites are really, I think it's magnified by the issue with the Zenite, and really that, you know, this is happening through no fault of their own. I think it might have been a little bit, I don't know, messier if it had something to do with these two different groups and their leaders. And I don't know, it just seems a clearer contrast that's pretty striking.
So we're getting close to an hour. Before we get into our final thoughts, I want to take a quick dip. We're going to reach into, I guess I should say, a long time Ready Room mainstay. And that would be Manny Coto's Magic Bag of Hindsight. Now, you might be asking yourself, why would Manny Coto have anything to do with the Cloud Minders? Why would there be something in his magic bag related to this? Well, as it turns out, at one point, maybe more than once, certainly in a past story on StarTrek.com, Manny Coto, who was the executive producer on Enterprise during the fourth season, said that if there had been a fifth season of Enterprise, they would have done a prequel episode to the Cloud Minders, which would have featured the city of Stratos. So, for those who are new to the show who don't know what Manny Coto's Magic Bag of Hindsight is, this comes from a few years back, especially when they were doing the Enterprise Blu-rays and they did all the interviews, and Manny Coto told us all these things that he would have done in season 5 of Enterprise. And it just, you know, makes you wonder what that season might have been like. So here he's saying a prequel to the Cloud Minders, which would have featured Stratos. So, Justin, what do you think they might have done, or what would you want to see as a prequel to the Cloud Minders that would help fill in the gaps and help you understand the story better and understand what's going on in this society?
Yeah, well, one thing they talk about in the Cloud Minders is that there's a certain point where everyone's living on the surface, And then, you know, a group of people decide to build this cloud city and they come there. And I think Vana says that the promise was eventually they would bring the troglites there as well. So maybe the prequel to it would be, you know, coming to that planet at the point where they were making the decision to build the cloud city and make this promise that they would bring the other people along. I'm not sure how the, you know, NX-01 crew would be a part of that. Maybe they in some way, you know, influence them to make this break or this change, or maybe they put them somehow on a course to becoming a Federation member later. I don't know. But I think that would be interesting, that period where they were all on the surface and thinking about building this cloud city.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too, of, you know, having seen them, well, they all had to be affected by the Xenite at once if they were all living there. And then how did that transform into them becoming mentally superior while those who stayed inferior? And then that process of, oh, well, we're going to get away from the surface and go up to the clouds. I'd like to see that.
Well, maybe the NX-01 does something that causes them to discover that there's Xenite on the planet and just kick off the whole thing.
We still might get our chance at seeing a prequel to this. Discovery's right around the corner, and maybe we'll have a cloud city in Discovery. Nice. Maybe, probably not, but you know, one can hope.
Maybe what happens there, Justin, is that Porthos takes a leak on a rock, and the chemical reaction helps them discover that Xenite is there. And then to apologize, Archer has to chop some wood, and then they can leave. But maybe it's Porthos who digs up the Xenite for the first time.
I think my thoughts on this are along the lines of Justin's.
I thought you were going to say, I think my thoughts on this are a lot more serious than yours.
No. I'm really fascinated. I mean, most of the evils that we see,
which is probably true,
most of the evils we see in the world and the situations we see in Star Trek that are already developed, you know, these societies that are already stratified, we don't get to see how they got to be that way. And most of those situations probably arose through some seemingly innocuous steps, right? And like you were saying, you know, we promise we're going to take you up to the cloud city with us. So we're going to build this cloud city, right? Some sort of song and dance about the good things that are yet to come, none of which ever come to fruition. And that leads to a lot of evil in the actual world and a lot of the already stratified societies we see in Star Trek. I just would like to see the development of those.
Mm-hmm. Well, one other thing that I want to mention before we do final thoughts, which I failed to mention earlier when we were talking about the stratification of society and the question, more importantly, of how a planet like this could become a Federation member. If you look at the DS9 episode Accession, in that episode, they're not talking about Ardana. They never mention Ardana. They're talking about Bajor. This is the episode where the Bajoran comes from 300 years in the past and he comes through. And there was a caste system on Bajor at the time called the Dajaras. And after the Cardassian occupation, the Dajaras system was gotten rid of. And this Bajoran who comes back through in Accession, he says that they need to go back to the Dajaras system. You know, he's explaining to Sisko that the Bajorans no longer follow their Dajaras. Artists have become soldiers. Priests have become merchants. Farmers have become politicians. And he sees this as somehow causing the society to fall apart. And then he's explaining later that we must heal the wounds of the occupation. We must return to our Dajaras. We must reclaim what we were and follow the path the prophets have laid out for us. And he goes on and he talks about this. And a lot of people are listening. Kira's listening. Sisko's listening. And of course, you know, Kira as a Bajoran, I don't see her as thinking that the Dajaras are anything that they should be going back to. So later he's talking to Sisko and they're discussing, you know, what would happen if the Dajaras were put back into place and what if someone defies their caste, what would happen to them? And Akoram, who's the guy, he says society will have appropriate remedies at its disposal, such as deportation. And Sisko says, you realize that caste-based discrimination goes against the Federation Charter. If Bajor returns to the Dajaras system, I have no doubt that its petition to join the Federation will be rejected. So at that point, it's made very clear that this is something that's completely unacceptable to the Federation. So Justin, going back to your question earlier in the discussion, how can Ardana be a Federation member planet with a caste system and one that must have been established before they became a Federation member? So Star Trek does address it later on in DS9, you know, very directly. I think that's the most direct that I can think of. That's the most direct dialogue about a caste system and how it plays into the Federation.
But this is something that comes up again and again in religions and in cultures. There are always these restorationist movements to try to get back to something more pure, something more ancient. And I could see that happening across the board in Federation worlds, you know, these movements that arise to try to return to something that was more local, more authentic for that culture, and throw the Federation membership into question.
Well, I think it's possible also that maybe they didn't have what you would consider a caste system at the time that they joined the Federation, and it came up later, and, you know, that Federation official who's making the rounds around the Federation hasn't gotten there since then, or maybe they just visit the Cloud City and its gift shop and they leave. I mean,
or someone's turning a blind eye, right? Because they want the Z-Knight.
To me, that seems unlikely, though, because a caste system... it takes a long time to form and take hold and become ingrained in the society. And the Federation's not very old at this point. The Federation's like 100-something years old at this point.
True.
So it's hard to imagine that a planet that joined the Federation not that many years earlier. In fact, I think Ardana joined the Federation only, well, it was 2263. So it's, you know, not very long at all that they've been a member. The Cloud Miners takes place in 2269, so we're talking six years. So, you know, certainly, but even if it were 60 years or if it were 100 years, I still don't think a caste system could become ingrained during that time. I mean, you could certainly take a bulk of the population, send them down to the mines, but to evolve to the point of being so exclusively focused on leisure and arts and culture like the Stratos dwellers are, that's something that I think takes centuries or millennia even.
Do you think the Federation president and his campaign advisors during the campaign had some secret negotiations with the ambassador from this world?
I think so. There was definitely some collusion going on there.
Backroom deals for sure.
Yeah. In fact, I think collusion was actually a working title for this episode, and then they changed it to the Cloud Minders.
I think we need a Star Trek author to write, you know, the history of Ardana and why they were allowed in the Federation with this caste system. We need it explained.
Good idea. Okay, well, let's wrap up. We have passed an hour, so let's do our final thoughts and our rating. So, Amy, share with us your final thoughts on the Cloud Minders.
Okay, well, I wanted to bring up a mathematically beautiful point in case anyone missed it.
I should warn you, I probably won't get this, Amy, if it involves math.
Well, it was just very interesting because this week, last week I was teaching other teachers at this conference about fractals and how beautiful they are. A fractal is a self-similar drawing, picture, what have you, that if you continually zoom either in or out, then it's self-similar. The Mandelbrot dot is one that most people would recognize. And one thing that I noticed from the episode when you're looking at the clouds and they have that shot down for that Canyon River system, that is a natural occurring fractal where that pattern and the rivers and the breaks off where they go, that is a fractal, just as like a mountain skyline or a snowflake is. And I just found it very mathematically beautiful. And so I was very appreciative that they had that in the episode.
And this is the shot when you're looking down on the planet, right? Mm-hmm. So in the remastered, I believe that's actually a shot that was taken by astronauts in the International Space Station.
I believe it. Yeah, it was beautiful. Yeah. So there's your little math lesson for
the day. All right. I feel smarter now.
Good. So why really did enjoy this episode, and I actually enjoy it now after our discussion. I think it has a lot of important morals to think about as we look at how are we in our society and how do we profess to be enlightened all while believing that people can't learn or treating them with the same equality that we would want to be treated and, you know, professing one thing and doing another. I think those are all good themes to look at. I'm going to give it 7 troglites out of 10.
Okay, very good. How about you, Justin?
Yeah, I mean, as I said at the top of the episode, now that I've rewatched this, I really appreciate the episode. It really had me thinking, you know, I think the best Star Trek episodes get you to think about your own life and your own time and the issues that we all face. And, you know, it got me thinking about inequality and, you know, what governments can and can't do and, you know, issues of the environment and torture. And there was just a lot that was going on in the episode that I found really thought-provoking. I thought it was well-written. And I enjoyed it quite a bit. And I think we could probably, you know, talk about some other aspects for another hour if we wanted to. So I really enjoyed it. Now I think it rates highly among the season 3 TOS episodes for me. And I would rate it as 8 out of 10 flirty Spocks.
Very good. How about you, Zachary?
Well, I've been trying to make the case that this episode is at least as relevant as it was in the 1960s and probably more so. I really feel that we are in serious danger of losing our ideals of egalitarianism and mutual respect and inclusiveness. And even worse than that, I think we're in danger of taking the position that the ruling class does in this episode, which is justifying inequality and turning that into a virtue. And this episode is a great warning, and it's a well-written episode, definitely one of the best in season 3. I've come kind of developed a new appreciation for this episode, having seen it again for the first time in a while. So I'm going to give this a fairly high rating for me for a TOS episode. I'm going to give this 9 out of 10 accelerated Ponfar cycles.
Wow. All right. Well, for me, I think the discussion today was very good and very interesting, and it raised a lot of points about how the story is still very applicable to today and things that we could learn from it and that we need to take away from it. I feel like I liked this episode more just as a Star Trek episode. I liked this episode more when I was younger, and as I watch it, I don't know, it just hasn't aged as well for me. I think that the concept is good and the message is good. I think it could be fleshed out a lot more. It feels like they didn't have the resources to tell the story the way they wanted to tell the story. And not only visually, although that's certainly lacking in many places, but even in the writing, it doesn't feel to me as tight and coherent as it could be. And it feels like there are areas they could have explored a bit more that they didn't. But it's still true to the ideals of the original series and the messages of the original series, which is what got me into Star Trek in the first place, meaningful social commentary, really looking at some of the ills of society, and while perhaps not offering precise solutions, you know, that would apply to our own world, at least they do attempt to make you think about it. And we see Droxine thinking about it a bit at the end. So for me, it's just an okay episode, but still one I think everyone should watch as they go through the original series. So I'm going to give it 4 misplaced cavern implements. All right. Well, Amy and Justin, thank you for joining us today to talk about the Cloud Minders. Before we go, Amy, tell everyone where they can find you around the interwebs and, of course, here on the network.
Well, I am, as you mentioned, a co-host of Earl Grey, Trek FM's dedicated podcast of The Next Generation. And so I enjoy hanging out at the Babel Conference, so you can find me there. I am also on Twitter at Miss Amy Nelson.
Very good. And Justin, how about you?
Well, you can find me on Twitter. My handle is TrekFan4747, where I tweet about nothing but Star Trek. And you can also find me hanging around the Babel Conference on Facebook.
Are you 4747? Because that's just like, it's like a double mint gum, right? It's just double your goodness.
Well, you know, originally I wanted to be TrekFan47 because of, you know, 47's incredible, yeah, you know, importance in Star Trek and the universe as a whole. But it was already taken, so I figured I would just add another 47. And I just took that one, but I do like it that it has it twice.
So when I see someone tweeting at us from TrekFan474747, I know that they will have had the same idea that you had originally, tried your solution, found that didn't work, and just went the extra step.
That's right. Don't accept any imitations. That wouldn't be me if it's 347s.
It's the sincerest form of flattery, though.
I like that. Don't accept any imitations from the guy who couldn't get TrekFan 47, so just added an extra 47 onto it.
Well, I think that person isn't doing much on Twitter, so I could be wrong by now, but...
All right. Well, thanks again, guys.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Thank you.
Well, Chris, that was so much fun talking with Amy and Justin about the Cloud Minders. This is an episode I hadn't watched in a long time. It was fun to get everyone's thoughts on it. And I really did seriously develop a new appreciation for this episode. Sometimes I feel like I say that and it sounds a little hollow, like it's an episode I've seen a bunch of times. And, you know, when I say that, it's like, okay, maybe it went up a tiny notch. This episode went up a big notch for me. I don't remember this being a terribly memorable episode, but I saw all the ways it's relevant to us in our society. And frankly, one of the little things I love about it is the tit-for-tat discussion that Plastic and Kirk have at the end, where they start throwing accusations at each other. Federation's not going to like that you abducted me, and my government's not going to like the fact that you took me into the cave. And someone finally says, you know, maybe both of these incidents are just best forgotten forever. And I think we need more of that in our society. People are resentful, and this group versus that group, this insult versus that insult. And collectively, we just need to go, you know, let's just put all this aside and talk about how we move forward as a society. And it's such a simple point, and I like that the episode takes the time to make it. So I just find this to be a really fascinating episode compared to a couple days ago, if you'd asked me.
Yeah. It's a great point. And I think that you can find that in many Star Trek episodes, the message that that's what we need to do. I think that's something that as Star Trek fans, we all need to take away, because I see a lot of division, even amongst Star Trek fans, not about Star Trek, but about other topics. And I really think as Star Trek fans, we should be able to communicate with each other better about those things. So hopefully people can take that away, not only from the Cloud Minders, but Star Trek in general. And I agree, it was really interesting talking about this today, but it's not the only thing we've been talking about here on the network. So here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, the Orb.
When Lieutenant Saru says, "I sense the coming of death," they could be playing staying alive in the background.
They're like, whatever, man. BG Sam, staying
alive. Aren't you listening to the sound system on this bridge?
Man, your bell bottoms too tight, boy.
That would be awesome if they had bell bottoms on the Discovery uniforms.
Meta Treks.
Garrick really personifies that snake-like way of kind of slithering around in the shadows, more subtle than any other character in the Star Trek universe.
Plain, simple Garrick would be the first to say that the clothes make the Cardassian.
Primitive culture. A look at history and culture through Star Trek.
This episode was actually banned by the BBC for many years. And they always said, I don't know if this is true, not so much because of the kind of allegorical significance of the episode, but because of this single line in it where Data says, he basically says, oh, well, you know, the IRA basically achieved what they wanted in, I think, 2024.
Yeah.
You know, it's coming up.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on iPhone, iPad, or Apple TV, or the desktop iTunes app to get the latest episodes as soon as they are published. As soon as we hit publish, it's going to come right out and ping your phone. If you're just looking at the iTunes store hoping for it to show up, it sometimes takes a while, can even take days. So please subscribe. That also helps us rise up in the rankings, which are based in part on lifetime subscriptions. And while you're there, please leave us a star rating and a written review. We do love to hear from you. If you're not an Apple user, don't worry, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone. In most third-party apps, you can also stream and download the MP3 file from our website or grab the RSS link. You can also find The Ready Room on Spotify, and you can also now find The Ready Room on iHeartRadio. And hopefully soon all of our shows will be available on iHeartRadio. I'm not sure about Spotify. They are still mulling over their options in the world of podcasting, and The Ready Room just happens to be one of the early shows that they picked up. All right. So, like I said, we would love to hear your thoughts, and if you'd like to let us know what you think about the Cloudminders or Mike Okuda's work with NASA or medical tricorders or anything else about Star Trek, there are many ways for you to get in touch with us. The best place to join in the larger conversation is in the Babel Conference. That's our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it should come right on up. And if you'd like to send me an email, you can do that by going to the website, trek.fm/contact. Use the form you find there, choose to send to a show, and select the Ready Room, and that'll come right on to me. You can also find the network on Twitter, where our username is TrekFM, and on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. Now, Zachary, when you're not down in the mines collecting a lot of Xenite because you have a plan to resell it on the black market to Federation operatives, where can people find you?
Well, you can find me all around Trek FM these days. You can find me every week on MetaTrek's Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy, along with my co-host over there, Mike Morrison. You can also find me on To the Journey, Trek FM's dedicated Voyager podcast, if you want to hear me talk about all things Voyager. And if you'd like to talk with me on Facebook, you can find me in Trek FM's listeners-only discussion group, the Babel Conference. That's a great place to join the discussion with me there. And you can always find me on Twitter. My handle is just my name, at Zachary Fruhling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, Fruhling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. And Chris, when you're not busy trying on your Xenite gas mask, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
Yeah, I lost my Xenite gas mask, so I'm trying to get back down to New Orleans. My cousins actually grew up there, and my uncle has connections to the parades, and so I'm getting the perfect spot in the Xenite parade, and I'm going to catch a new gas mask. That way, I'll be able to help Kirk on his return to Ardana. But when I'm not planning that trip, you can find me, of course, in the listeners group, the Babel Conference on Facebook. You can also find me on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones, a letter C and Brian with a Y. That's my username on Facebook also, and pretty much everywhere in social media. And you can find my writing about Star Trek on the official website at StarTrek.com. Just search for my name, C. Brian with a Y, Jones, as three elements, and should come up there in search. And elsewhere on the network, I do only one other show right now, and that's The Orb with Matthew Rushing. That is our dedicated Deep Space Nine show, and that comes out, it's a little bit irregular right now as I get back into things after my medical leave, but we have a lot of episodes for you there talking about Deep Space Nine, so check that out if you're interested in hearing me on other podcasts. And if you dig into the archives, you'll find me on, I don't know, like eight different shows on the network, because I used to host a lot more. So be sure to dig into the archives. I also want to give just another plug. I know we did the previously on Trek FM thing, but I do want to remind everyone that we have the master feed, and the master feed contains every episode of everything that we do and also some other special things. So if you only listen to this show, or you only listen to, let's say, The Ready Room and Metatrex, and you want to find out about the really, really wide range of topics that we have here on Trek FM, go subscribe to the Trek FM Complete Master Feed, because every day you're going to get 2, 3, 4 new podcast episodes covering everything from music to philosophy to history, all the different series, science. We even have stuff outside of Star Trek on the 602 Club if you're a fan of Star Wars or James Bond or anything like that. I don't think Matthew's done a Golden Girls episode, though, yet. Has he, Zachary?
I don't think so, but he should.
I'd listen to that. Anything else, you know, anything besides Golden Girls, you're probably going to find it in there. So go check that out. And you can find the Master Feed in all those places that we mentioned earlier.
I listen to the Master Feed mainly. It's so much easier than trying to track down. We have so many shows on Trek FM now. It can be a challenge in keeping track of which shows have new episodes. And the Master Feed is a great place just to tune in and see what's happening today.
It is. It does make it very, very easy. Zachary, I'd also like to take a moment before we go to thank our associate producers here on The Ready Room. Of course, that's Renee Roberts, also Norman C. Lau, Sam Piasek, K. Elizabeth Shaw, Tim Robertson, David Shuford, Jukim, and some guy named Zachary Fruhling.
I hear he's a great guy.
So thank you. Thank you, Zachary, for your long-running support of this show as an associate producer before you even became a host here on the network. And of course, thank you, Renee, Sam, Kay, Tim, David, too, for your support. And of course, Kay is a host now as well. You're co-host on To The Journey, Zachary.
I think it's actually really interesting that a great many of the current hosts on Trek FM started out as associate producers and they got involved in the Babel Conference. There's kind of been a natural evolution from interacting to guesting on shows to hosting our own shows. There was like a like an astronaut class of us.
I guess there was. You know, it's, I mean, people ask sometime, and it's not like a thing where you pay and then you get to be part of the network. It's not anything like that. It's just that I find that the people who do contribute money at the level to become an associate producer, which is $25 per month or higher, the reason they do it is because they love the network and they love Star Trek, and they're very enthusiastic about being part of it. And because of that drive and enthusiasm that they have, they just kind of naturally become more of a part of what we're doing. And that's great, because that's why we've been going now. We're in our seventh year, is because we have that lifeblood running through the network, and more people come through that want to be part of it.
And I think we all have the same desire, the same drive. You know, I think we're maybe all a little frustrated by not being able to have the kinds of conversations about Star Trek narrowly, but about culture and knowledge and philosophy more generally, with the way the world's culture has gone. And we all collectively sought out a place to build a great place to have a great conversation with people we like.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, speaking of that, I mean, if you do want to have that kind of conversation and you're not yet a podcast host, you can do that by supporting us on Patreon at the $15 per month level or higher. We have the Patrons Roundtable, and once a month we have a gathering. Sometimes it happens more than once a month, but we have a gathering of patrons and hosts, and we get in a meeting just like we're in right now, and we pick a topic like we did today, and we talk about it, and we record that, and we put it in the master feed so that the rest of the audience can listen to you as a listener, as a patron, having a discussion about Star Trek. So that's a great way to dip your toes into the water. And you can do that and get all kinds of other perks. We have a special website called Patron Zone, where we have early access to episodes. We have artwork, ringtones. We have all kinds of stuff up there. That's available at the $5 per month or higher level. And you can find out about all of this if you go to patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm. Everything you need to know is there. You can contribute whatever amount you would like. We really appreciate your support. It does cost quite a lot of money to produce and host and distribute all of these podcasts every month. As I mentioned, we put out 2, 3, 4 per day, every day, 7 days a week. So there is a lot of work and a lot of expense behind that. So I really appreciate all your support, everyone who is a patron of the network. Thank you so much. And please go check it out, patreon.com/trekfm. Well, Zachary, I'm going to head over and talk to the Stratos guards. I want to see if I can borrow one of those little blue outfits they have and wear that as my cosplay to the next Star Trek Las Vegas.
Well, Chris, you know I'm a philosopher, so I'm going to get my head back in the clouds, head up there to Stratos. So I think it's time to stick a Zenite gas mask in it, because the Ready Room is done.